We'll be giving Brendan a warm welcome. He's our speaker.
I'm still a two-fisted drinker, except now it's just water. My name is Brendan, and I am an alcoholic. And I'm an Irish Catholic from the south side of Chicago. So let me start off by wishing everybody a belated happy St. Patrick's Day, a couple of days late, and a happy St. Joseph's Day, because this is St. Joseph's Day. Where I grew up on the south side, we had the Irish would celebrate St. Patrick's Day wearing green, and the Polish, Italian, and Lithuanians would celebrate St. Joseph's Day wearing red, and we always had battles on the days in between. I'm going to try my best to share my experience, strength, and hope, and tell you what it was like, what happened, and to some extent what it's been like after it happened. My first experience with alcohol, I think my first real experience was when I was... I think I was 14, and my parents had gone out, and I don't know what possessed me. I really don't know what the thinking was, other than alcoholic thinking, that I wanted to try some really hard liquor. And my parents were not alcoholics, but they liked to have parties and people over, so we had a fairly well-stocked liquor cabinet. And I mean, it was well, it had everything: vodka, gin, scotch, bourbon, Southern Comfort, cream de menthe, all that kind of stuff. So being a fairly intelligent young man, I figured if I drank a lot of anything, it would be quite obvious. So my approach was to drink a little bit of everything. So I got a big 12-ounce glass, and I took a little bit of everything and poured it in and fired it right down, which is about the only way you could drink something like that, because that's not something you would think of savoring. And it was about as disgusting as you could imagine it was, and it took about 5 minutes before it was like getting hit in the back of the head with a 2x4. It was just, I mean, it was literally drove me to my knees. And then it took, 3 to 5 minutes after that before it all came back. And I barely made it to the bathroom in time. And I swore I was never going to do that again. And I didn't until I was about 17. And then a good friend of mine came over, and his mother owned a bar. And it was perfect timing because he came over, we ordered some pizzas, and we had a fifth of vodka. And between the two of us, over the course of about an hour and a half, finished it off. I remember that night because we were out on the front lawn of my folks' house trying to see how many pieces of pizza we could stuff in our mouth at the same time. I won. I got 4 pieces in my mouth at one time as we were rolling along on the grass in the front of the house. Didn't have much experience with alcohol after that until I was a senior in college. And had a few times when I would say I got kind of overserved over the holidays, but nothing too severe. My drinking career, and that kind of proves I'm an alcoholic because only an alcoholic would consider it a career, really began when I was about 23, 24. And my marriage was not doing very well. As a matter of fact, it was to the point where I couldn't stand going home. And I didn't know what I was going to do other than go home. I figured sitting in Grant Park, because I worked downtown Chicago, sitting in Grant Park for 4 or 5 hours wasn't going to do too well, especially since it was October at the time. It's getting a little cold in Chicago. So I decided that what I would do is go have a few drinks with the guys after work. That rapidly escalated until I was not getting home at 8 or 9 o'clock. I was getting home at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, taking a shower and going right out to work the next day. That lasted for a few years, and I was having a good time with it, until it, somewhere along the way, it began to occur to me that I wasn't using alcohol anymore, it was using me. My best drinking buddy, we would talk about alcoholism, and we got to the point where he was studying alcoholism a great deal, and he was telling me about the fact that there was like four stages of alcoholism, and we were only stage three alcoholics. And I thought, well, that's pretty good. And some people would think, well, that's terrible that you're already to stage three as an alcoholic. I was very proud of it. It was like my profession. That's what I did as a living, was drink. And that truly was the way I thought of it. If somebody had asked me, what do you do? I drink. And it was kind of like, you know, there's people that are certified accountants, there's lawyers, there's doctors, and then there's alcoholics. And I was a certified alcoholic. And that's how I looked at it. And it stayed that way through my divorce. And then I was living with a woman for a while, and it was getting really, really pretty bad. Good friend of mine, there was two episodes near the end that really drove home how bad this was. The first one was my best friend stopped over at the apartment my girlfriend and I were living in, and he never did that. I mean, this was the only time he dropped by out of nowhere. And the difficult part was I had told him I wasn't going to be drinking anymore. And when he dropped by, of course, I was drinking. And I hid this glass of some kind of booze, I don't know what it was at the time, behind this pot. Now, I hid it behind the pot so that you couldn't see it from the place I was standing, but you could see it from everywhere else in the room. And he walked in and saw it, and I was just humiliated. The next episode was only a few months later. My girlfriend and I had a big fight, and I had walked out of the apartment, and now I'm back living with my parents. Here I am, 26 years old, back living with my parents because there was no place else to go. And this was the moment when I knew the game was up. And I can remember it like it happened this morning. It was about 1:15 in the morning. I'm standing in my parents' kitchen, and I'm drinking apricot brandy out of a cordial glass, because if you're going to drink apricot brandy, you got to drink it out of a proper glass. And the reason I'm drinking apricot brandy is not because I like it, but because that was the only alcohol that was left in the house, because I had drank everything else. And I'm thinking, I can't stand this stuff. Apricot brandy is really just awful, just terrible. And I realize I can't see going on living having to drink. And at the same moment, I'm thinking, I can't face life without drinking. It's exactly, if you read the big book and in the vision for you, it describes exactly that scene. Exactly that scene. And I realized the jig was up, that what was probably going to happen was that I was going to end up killing somebody while I was driving drunk, and I was going to end up in prison, and that's how my life was going to end. Little did I know, about 2 months later, I was going to find this program and change my life. I got back with my girlfriend, and who's now my wife, and has been my wife for many, many years. And on May 1st, 1978, she decided that since I was having a problem with alcohol, she was going to go to an Al-Anon meeting. And that was the first day I didn't pick up a drink. And I got through the next week telling myself, anytime I wanted to pick up a drink, that would be the worst time possible to pick up a drink, so don't pick up a drink. She went to that Al-Anon meeting. She came home that night. And I was curious as to how this went. And she said, it was okay. And they have an AA meeting the next week. And I said, well, okay, maybe I'll try it out. And she said, I don't think you're going to like it because it's a spiritual program. And I didn't hear spiritual. I heard religious. And since I had left the seminary many years before, there was no way I was going for anything that had anything to do with religion. I knew so little about AA that it never dawned on me that maybe there was a meeting before the following week. So I figured I would have to wait until the next week to go to an AA meeting. And as I said, I got through that meeting that week just gritting my teeth. The following week, She went to the Al-Anon meeting. I walked in, and I literally just walked in to an AA meeting. And had no idea what I was going to encounter. I had thought the only thing I could envision about AA, especially when she said it was a spiritual program, was that it was going to be like a Southern Revival meeting, you know, where you walk in and there's a tent, everybody says, "Jesus, I'm saved." And that's exactly what I thought I was going to find. And I walked in, and it was a number of tables, and people were sitting around the tables, and they looked up at me and said, are you looking for an AA meeting? And I said, yeah. And they said, well, what are you hoping to find? And I said, all I'm looking to find is some peace and serenity. I didn't care about not drinking. I just wanted to find some peace in my life. And they said, well, you're in the right place. Come on back here. We'll have a first step meeting for you. And I remember I had to have been one of the most obnoxious people they ever had for their first night, because naturally I'm a control freak, so I wanted to know how does this work? What happens? How long does it take? What do you do next? And they were very patient with me. And one of the guys at the table said, I'm going to be your sponsor. And that's how I got my sponsor. And we started off going through the steps. For me, the first step was a piece of cake. As I said, I already knew I was a third stage alcoholic, so saying I was an alcoholic, that wasn't too bad. The part about being powerless, I kind of skipped that part. I'm an alcoholic, we'll go on with that. Second step, you know, came to believe in a power greater than ourselves. I was born an Irish Catholic. I went through Catholic school for 12 years. So the fact that there was a God, yeah, I got that. Okay. Step three, turn our will. Okay, yeah, of course, there's a God. Step four, not so much. Not so much. And back in the days when you had a problem doing step four, the way your sponsor worked it was he scheduled your fifth step. So now you got to do your fourth step, right? Because if you've scheduled your fifth step, you got to have something when you come in there. And he gave me a few weeks to do it, and I couldn't do it. And I found out later on, much, much later on, that the rule is when you can't get through a step, go back to the step before. And I didn't know it at the time, but that's what I had to do, because the truth of the matter was I hadn't taken the third step. I had not really taken the third step. The idea of turning my will and my life over to anything or anybody was something I just couldn't do. I looked at it that I had spent my entire life, which wasn't all that long at that point, but at that point it was my entire life, trying to get free, trying to be able to do whatever I wanted to, looking for freedom. And now I finally had it, and now you're telling me I'm supposed to turn my life over to somebody else. No, not going to happen. Not going to happen. And I remember how I took my third step. If you read the book or if you talk to people today, they say you do a joint third step, you get together with your sponsor, you go someplace. That's not how I did my third step. I was walking the dog. It was an August night. I was walking the dog about 11:30 at night, and I am so angry, I think waves of anger are coming off my body. And I'm miserable. I am just miserable. And I remember, I'm walking the dog, and I'm next to the dumpster, and I look up at the sky, and this is exactly how I took the third step. These are the words I used. Well, God, if you're so goddamn good, you take it. And that's how I did my third step. And believe it or not, it worked. It worked. Because the next day, I did my fourth step. One day, sat down for 6 hours, asked God to help me, and spit it all out. And so I was able to make my fifth step appointment. And I remember after doing the fifth step, they talk about sometimes in the book, you'll feel like this load. I got done doing the fifth step, and I'm walking back to my car after being over at my sponsor's house. And honest to God, I feel like I can float. I'm not sure my feet were touching the ground. I felt so relieved that the boulders of life and all everything had just been taken off me, and I could actually float above the ground. It was absolutely unreal. And then I went home, and we did the sixth and seventh step like the next day, and I did it like it said in the book, and I realized much later on that you got to work the sixth and seventh step a little harder than this. But at the time, it worked. I realized I didn't want to be the person that was in my fifth step anymore. And that was enough to get through the sixth and seventh step. I found out much later that it takes a little bit longer than that, but it worked for the time being. So now we go into the eighth and ninth step. And so my sponsor said, the first thing you do is you make a list. So I made a list. Then we talk about it. And there was a number of people I didn't have on my list that my sponsor suggested I put on. Actually, my sponsor really didn't suggest that I put these people on. He told me to put these people on, and that's what happened. Let me explain. The first miracle I experienced in this program, I've experienced tons of miracles, but three that really I acknowledge have changed my life. The first one happened, I don't know when, but somewhere around the eighth or ninth step was that I realized I didn't have a compulsion to drink anymore. I didn't have the compulsion to drink. And that, to me, was a miracle because I didn't think that was ever going away. I remember the first 20, 30 days, I would be at work, and it would be 12:30 in the afternoon, which by now I would have typically gone out and hammered down four Manhattans in about half an hour. And I'm thinking, I got to have a drink. I got to have a drink. And I remember that, you know, it said you're supposed to pray. And so I said, okay, God, it's 12:30. If I feel like this at 12:40, I'm going to get a drink. And the next time I looked on my watch, it was 2 o'clock. And I got to tell you, I thought, this shit works. This really works. So that was the first miracle. The second miracle happened when I was doing the eighth and ninth step. I got through a number of the standard ones, my parents, my brother and sister, people like that. And then there was the one that I couldn't do, and that was my ex-wife. And they said, you know, you got to do this one. And I said, there's no make amends. I had these visions, this kind of Victorian scene where it would be winter, and you know, winters in Chicago at that time were really just miserable. Blizzards, 25 below zero, and I'm not exaggerating, that's what it was like at the time. And all I could envision was she'd be coming to the door looking for shelter in the middle of a blizzard, and I'd open the door and see it was her and slam the door in her face. That's how I thought about this woman, and they're telling me I'm supposed to make amends. They said, well, here's what you're supposed to do. Get on your knees in the morning and at night and pray for blessings for her. I thought, you've got to be kidding me. They said, you don't have to mean it. You just have to say the words. I thought, well, okay, I'll give that a try. And so I did. And I got down on my knees every morning and every night and prayed for blessings for her. It took me 6 months. But after 6 months, I was ready to make amends. And I kept that up to the point where it actually got to the point where I actually wished well for her. I really did hope she had a good life and began to see my responsibilities. And that was the second miracle, because I didn't think that resentment would ever, ever, ever go away. But it did. And the first, we talk about having a spiritual awakening, and really the promises talk about you will comprehend the word serenity and you will know peace. And that happened to me when I got to speak for the very first time. I was sober about just about a year, and my sponsor said, it's time for you to speak at a meeting. And this was a fairly large meeting. They held it in the cafeteria of the hospital, and there was about 150 to 200 people. And I'm thinking, I don't know what I'm going to do here. And I'm getting ready, my wife and I are getting ready to go to the meeting, and it's kind of snowing. And I go outside, and my wife had driven the car earlier that day and had not checked the gas gauge. So I go out to get in the car, and I turn the key, and there's nothing. And My normal reaction would have been to rip off the steering column and smack her in the head with it. And at this moment, I was completely peaceful. I thought, God will provide. Whatever is supposed to happen will happen, and it will be okay. And I called my sponsor, and he came and picked this up, and we got to the meeting, and I was able to go through the whole thing. And I thought, this is what it feels like. This is just absolutely amazing that you can have that feeling. And that feeling lasted for hours. And that was, then it was back to reality and back to life. And it was a challenge. My wife and I, well, my girlfriend and I got married. And one of the experiences I had was, you know, they talks about in the book where at some point you will have no defense against the first drink. Now, we got married on a Saturday afternoon, and what was interesting is on the way from the ceremony to the reception, we had a head-on collision and smashed the car, and somehow both of us came out okay. And I should have realized that was just going to be my history of having head-on collisions with things all through my life. So we get through that. We survive that event. We go out on our honeymoon, and we're out to dinner. We're out to dinner. And it's a fairly fancy, nice dinner. And I asked my wife, do you want wine with dinner? And she said, I don't know. She said, nah, if you're not having wine, I don't want wine. And of course I said, well, I could have a glass of wine. And she said, do you really think you should? I said, I don't think a glass of wine will hurt. And she said, nah, I don't think so. I said, okay. And that was it. Didn't have wine. All she had to have done was say, yeah, I think I'd like a glass of wine. And I'd have had a glass of wine. And I don't know that I would have ever, ever, ever gotten back. And that's how God has worked in my life. God has done those miracles in my life constantly, constantly. So that's how I got through the steps the first time. I remember the other event I remember going through the steps was, I think I had just done the fourth step and I hadn't quite met my sponsor for the fifth step. And I was still struggling with how do you live life happily without booze? How do you have a good time? And I had thought what was going to happen was I was going to live a very glum, boring life and never have any fun again. But it was okay, because at least I wasn't drinking. And I found to my chagrin that that's not how it works at all. That all the characteristics that I have normally are still all there. There is still a long way to go. And it's taken a long time to make any progress with that. The events after that, I will share you a little bit what it's like, or what it was like since getting through the steps. I remember I was sober about 3 years. Now, I got sober in a western suburb of Chicago. 2 years later, moved to Indianapolis. 2 years after that, moved to Detroit. 3 years after that, moved to St. Louis, then went back to Chicago, and since then I've lived in San Diego and I've lived here. So I've had the opportunity to get to lots of different meetings in lots of different places. And it's been a struggly time. I've told the story a few times that when I move to a new city or I start working in a new city, there's two things I look for: where to get a good haircut and good AA meetings. Those are the two things. Once I've got those, I don't care if I even have a place to live. As long as I've got that, I'm set. So we had moved to Detroit. So I've been sober maybe 3 years now, and maybe four. And I'm still dealing with my primary emotion, which is anger. I had two emotions that I operated 99% of the time on: fear and anger. And I'm still struggling with the anger. And I remember one day my wife and I had a particularly unpleasant conversation, and I was blowing up all over the place. And my wife made the comment, I liked you better when you drank. And I thought, oh yeah, I'll show you. And my thought was, I'm going to go get a drink. And then I realized that would be the worst thing I could possibly do. And that's when I started thinking of booze in a different way. At that time, my reaction to booze was, it was the devil. This is the devil tempting me now. Years later, I've developed a different perspective. When I think about taking a drink, I think of the biggest, fattest, nastiest, ugliest rattlesnake and picking it up and shoving it in my face, because that's exactly what it would be if I picked up a drink. The other thought that comes to mind when I think of picking up a drink is the fact that I've never in my life wanted a drink. I wanted to get drunk, but I never wanted a drink. When I was drinking and I would say, well, I think I'll go think through some difficult problem and I'll go have a drink. And six drinks later, I haven't even thought about the problem and I can't remember what the hell the problem was in the first place. So I was lucky in that regard, in that I've never toyed with the idea of, since the incident with the glass of wine, I've never toyed with the idea of I would like to go have a drink, because I know I don't want to drink. I just want to get drunk. I want to run away and hide without having to go anyplace, and that's what booze did. I've learned lessons over time by God teaching me and every once in a while keeping my ears open. I got a lesson in how to do the 10th and 11th step when I was talking to a guy after a meeting, and he said, I just don't know how to do this 10th and 11th step. And I said, well, maybe what you should do is just read it every day until it becomes common practice. And I thought, that's a hell of an idea. I think I should try that. And that's how I started doing the 10th and 11th step. Every morning I would open the big book and I'd read those pages and I'd go through that to the point where I've got it memorized now. Now I go through it just automatically. Same thing happened with the same guy. Matter of fact, a few months later, he said, you know, I just can't get this gratitude thing. I just can't get it. And I said, well, why don't you try every morning and every night thinking and writing down five things to be grateful for? And if you can't come up with five things to be grateful that God has given you, come up with five things that you're grateful God hasn't given you. And if you can't come up with either one of those, give me a call, I'll help you. And once again, I thought, you know, that's a hell of a good idea. I should try that. And I did. And that's become common practice. I got lessons in humility from this program. I was sober probably 20, 22 years, and I was at a meeting, and there was a woman there. She had been sober a few months. And I was sharing at the meeting, and my style of sharing is usually just to talk about what it's like. And a lot of times, I'm still struggling. You know, I may be having days when I'm still dealing with the alcoholic in my head. And so at the end of the meeting, she said, well, how long have you been sober? And I said, well, how long do you think I've been sober? And she said, oh, at least 6-8 weeks. So whenever I think I've been around this program a long time and really know a lot, I think back to that story and realize, nah, it hasn't been that long. But I've learned a lot of things. I'll share a few of them. Guy I have a lot of respect for in the program. As a matter of fact, he and I now sponsor each other. I've got about 4 years more sober than he, and he's about 4 years older than me, so it kind of cancels itself out. So we sponsor each other. We sponsor each other. And he taught me the five things that I'm supposed to do every day. And there's been variations on it, but if you've been around, you probably have heard some of this. One, first thing in the morning, get on my knees and ask God to relieve me from the compulsion to drink, or ask him to keep me sober that day. And I've adopted that to the point where, rather than possibly forgetting, the way I get out of bed, I don't stand up. I roll off the side of the bed onto my knees, and I'm here. And my prayer to God is incredibly simple. God, please help me. I need your help. So that's number one. Number two, call another alcoholic. Number three, read some AA literature. Now, what I've done over the past many years now is I read the big book, and I read two pages a day, just two. Left page, right page, left page, right page. If you do that, you read the big book from cover to cover 4 times a year. And if you really do that, you don't just read it, you're actually studying it. So read some AA literature. Any day you possibly can, get to a meeting. And any day you haven't had to pick up a drink, get on your knees that night and thank God for keeping you sober. And that's worked for me. Now that I've been in the program a long time, another thing I've learned is that I will never be an ascended being. I am never going to be all spirit floating above the clouds. Because I thought, when I first walked into my first meeting, there was a guy in the room who had 29 years sober. And I thought, I'm not 29 years old. This guy's got 29 years sober. And I thought, well, by the time I get 29 years sober, I will be pure spirit. I will be perfect. I will never have anger issues. I will be... And I've learned, no, that ain't the way it works. That ain't the way it works. I still have to get through each day just gutting it out some days, just gutting it out. I've learned that how I feel about doing these steps has absolutely nothing to do with it. Because I used to think, you know, you feel the warmth of God. You feel the Spirit touch you. No, most days it ain't there. Maybe tiny glimpses for milliseconds, but most days it ain't there. I've got to learn to do what I have to do, whether I feel like it or not. And that was a hard lesson, and that takes a lot of practice. And that's the other thing I learned. If I want to have a strong spirit, I have to work my spirit. Just like if I want to be in good shape, I've got to do exercises, I've got to do physical exercise. If I want to know stuff, I've got to work at it. If I want a strong spirit, I've got to work at it. See, I always believed I wanted to be a person of high self-esteem, good character, as long as it didn't take any work. You know, that's, and then I found out if you want to be a person of good self-esteem, you have to do esteemable things. And that a lot of time takes a lot of will. That was one of the things I learned from the big book. It's not a matter of having too much will. It's a matter of putting my will in the wrong direction. And that was quite enlightening for me. And that was a great relief for me, that all I had to do was do the right work and I'd be okay. I've gone through more difficult times in the program than I did before I got to the program. I remember, and this is only going back 7 or 8 years ago, I went through a very black time. And these events stick in my mind just like it happened a moment ago. And I remember I was back in Chicago, and it was a hot August day. It was in the upper 80s. It was the middle of the day. I was walking the dog. But I was in the deepest, foulest depression I've ever been in my life. And although it was a sunny day and warm and all that, as far as I was concerned, everything was black. I mean, just black. And it's funny when I look back on it now, because I remember telling God, if you're not going to help me, to hell with it. I'm going to go drink. So here I am threatening God that I'm going to go drink. And it wasn't shortly after that he whacked me upside the head. And that's one of the metaphors I use. God speaks to me all the time. All the time. Mostly through other people, sometimes through readings, but mostly through other people. And most of the time, I can't hear him, because majority of the time, God is speaking to me in a small, quiet voice. And all the voices in my head and all that sound and cacophony in my head has to shut up in order for me to hear it. But God cares for me so much that if I don't listen to that small, quiet voice for long enough, he hits me across the face with a 2x4. And I mean literally across the face with a 2x4. And I wake up and realize what's going on. And that black time really woke me up. One of the biggest problems I've had in this program, and as I mentioned about the powerless piece, surrender. I don't surrender. I am strong enough, smart enough, powerful enough, willful enough, I can make anything happen if I put my mind to it. And that's how I believe. And this is going back about 6 years ago now. I still had that. I trusted God to be my master and had the power that I could tap into. But as far as surrendering to God, no, I hadn't done that. I really hadn't done that. And so God, like I said, literally with a 2x4. Starting in October of 2010, God broke me down to the point where I was willing to surrender. October of 2010, I had my left knee replaced because the bone in my leg had gotten a cyst in it, and it was my leg was ready to shatter at any point in time. So I got my left knee replaced in October of 2010. In March of 2011, so 6 months later, I got my right shoulder replaced because the arthritis has gotten so bad that there was just bone on bone. I didn't get the idea of surrendering yet. So in October of 2012, I had double heart bypass surgery. Still didn't get it. So in July of 2014, I had my right knee replaced. And in October of 2014, I had my left shoulder replaced. And then in April of 2015, I had to have my right shoulder replaced with a reverse shoulder replacement. And then in August of 2015, I had to have my left shoulder replaced because it had broken inside and it was tearing my shoulder apart. I got the message. I finally got to the point of saying, okay, God, I'm not in charge. And I was broken down enough to say, I surrender. And by this time, the reason I was able to surrender is my concept of God had changed. When I first got in this program, and it took me a while to realize this, but when I first got in this program, my concept of God was my father. Mm-hmm. This, you do this, you don't do that, you do this, and if you do that, you get punished, and that's how I envisioned God. Over time, my vision of God softened a little bit to the point where it wasn't quite so nasty. But over the several operations and some serious counseling, I had a different concept of God. Now my concept of God, there was a guy in a meeting many years ago who said he had been a minister, a psychiatrist. This guy was brilliant. And he said, you know, I finally come to realize that any concept of God that I can have diminishes God, because I can only think of God in my own human context. And so I don't have any concept of God other than it's a loving personality, and that's it. And that's how my concept of God evolved. Today, my concept of God is really twofold. One is that loving personality, and for me, the other part is the feminine part of a loving, nurturing, caring being that really cares for me. And that changed it. I'm going to wrap up here with the last miracle. I said I had three miracles. The first one was the compulsion. The second one was resentment. The third one happened for me the first time when I was sober about 15 years. And I tell people this because it is the most important thing that's ever happened in my life. I was in danger of losing my job, and I was full of fear and anxiety. And I was praying to God, I don't know what to do. I don't know what to do. And God took me through, or showed me the steps through what would happen. And I realized, I'm going to be okay. I'm going to be okay. That I'm worried about all the gravy, and meantime, God has always given me the meat and potatoes. So I'm arguing about what kind of sauce I get to put on it. And I realized, God has never let me down. God has always had my back. Now, when I say this miracle, I've experienced this miracle. I've experienced this miracle many times. Being an alcoholic, I constantly forget that I've experienced it. And I walk back into the same trap of doubting whether God has got my back. And he constantly shows me. And I'll tell you, this time I had the sense, and I can't put it into words. I really can't put this into words because there's no words to describe it. But there was this knowing better than I know me, better than I know anything, that God will make sure it's okay. All I have to do is keep trying. And I hope my story has told you that my trying has failed many times. It's just been miserable many times. But I've never given up trying. Even when I'm angry at God and screaming at God, I still kneel down and pray. I still do all the things I'm supposed to do. And I know that as long as I keep trying, as long as I keep showing up, God will make sure everything is okay. And I tell people that I guarantee it for them. I will guarantee with my life, and I mean this sincerely, with my life, that if you do that, if you just keep trying, God will guarantee everything will be okay. Now, okay doesn't mean what you like, what you want. It means that you will be okay. And if you haven't experienced that miracle yet, then I beg you to keep coming back. Because I guarantee you, if you keep coming back at some point, you will experience that miracle. That's my experience. Thank you.
Let's give Brendan another hand. Now I'm going to turn it back over to Tom.
Thank you, Peter. Thank you, Brendan. Really enjoyed your share. And I want to thank some other people, too. First of all, Peter, for being our leader, and Trish and Tina for reading this evening, along with Kristen doing a wonderful job with the chips, and Billy for filling up and finishing up on the raffle with me. I want to thank also Joanne for the candy and the treats, Tony for making coffee and making certain it was always fresh, and filling up the cream. Well, I'll do that. He's gone then. Never mind. I also want to thank the people who set this room up. That was Pat, Lisa, and Trish earlier this afternoon, and for the folks who volunteered to set the meeting back up, thank you. And let's see, Ron, keep coming back. You're the only one with less than 30 days. And all the rest of you, please keep coming back. And now I've asked Joanne to close us out in her prayer of her choice.
Before, but I mean, you.